Could Ohio Democrats take back one of the state's U.S. Senate seats? Sherrod Brown is reportedly planning to run in November to try to get his old job back. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, we'll discuss what his chances are against Senator John Husted. Plus, a look at crime in Cincinnati, what the numbers say, and how residents feel about public safety. Then another former elected official looking to get his old job back, this time on Cincinnati City Council. Joining me now to get our Friday news review started are Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler, and Cleveland.com chief politics reporter Jeremy Pelzer. Welcome back, Karen and Jeremy.
Hi there.
Hello.
Thanks for being with us. Jeremy, so it's official, Sherrod Brown is running to be a U.S. Senator again?
Well, I guess it's not official yet because he has so far not announced. But according to several people that I've talked to, he has told them that he is running for U.S. Senate. This is a something that has been speculated about for months. It's been back and forth about whether he might run for governor or Senate or nothing at all. And this is probably the best news that Democrats would want to hear, at least in terms of the Senate race. Although an awful lot of Democrats also wanted to see Brown run for governor because there's a whole lot of holes to fill for the Democrats, and Sherrod Brown is kind of their best bet.
So, Jeremy, when is he expected to make an official announcement about this?
He hasn't said anything publicly yet. I expect it's going to be soon. I think it's also going to break a dam that's been in place for months where Democrats running for other offices have been waiting to see what Sherrod does. That's not only for governor, but for down ticket races as well. And part of that is because they're looking at running in 2026, and they want it. One big factor is who's at the top of the ticket. And if they feel that there is someone strong at the top of the ticket who can help their chances, then they'll be more likely to jump in.
Karen, talk a little bit more about what his entry into this race means for Ohio Democrats.
Well, I have to give Jeremy credit because his story earlier in the week kind of set this whole thing off, where he talked to labor leaders who had said that Sherrod Brown had told them he was going to run for Senate and not for governor, which I think a lot of us had heard that he was interested in pursuing. But there have been pictures on social media of him with Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer in Columbus, out in public last month and in June. So that was kind of hinting that he was headed toward the Senate direction. I think that this is it's a hugely significant announcement because Sherrod Brown is the most recognizable name in Democratic politics in Ohio. And I think he was pretty clear when he left the Senate that he was not done yet. He set up this Dignity of Work Institute earlier this year, I think kind of to talk about some of the issues that he will likely campaign on, that he's campaigned on all along, issues related to the struggles of people, working people, lower wage workers, minimum wage workers, that sort of thing. So I think we're still waiting for the official announcement, but I think it's not going to be long. He had said it was going to be sometime in the next couple of months. I think that was back earlier this year.
Karen, do the state's Democrats think, the Democratic leaders think he has a chance of winning? I mean, President Trump won Ohio so decisively in 2024.
Well, Sherrod Brown has had a history of success on ballots that Republicans won. I mean, Republicans have won statewide 82% of statewide races in Ohio since 1994. But Sherrod Brown had three terms in the U.S. Senate. So there was definitely an appeal for him for voters who would split their tickets. And I mean, when you look at some of the other races in 2018, for instance, when Governor Mike DeWine, who Sherrod Brown defeated in 2006 to get to the U.S. Senate, when DeWine won the governor's office in 2018, Sherrod Brown also won. So he's had some appeal to Republican voters in Ohio because I think he's talked about the issues, the economic issues that they are concerned about. But Democrats or Republicans will also point out that he's got a very progressive record. He's very closely tied to a lot of high profile Democrats in Washington. So it's going to be an interesting campaign.
Jeremy, you mentioned that Sherrod Brown was considering a run for governor, too. Any idea why he decided on the Senate instead of the governor's race?
That's the $64,000 question. I think a lot of people, including many insider Democrats, thought up until 2 or 3 weeks ago that Sherrod Brown was ready to run for governor. One sign that he was going to do so was that Brown pushed hard to get Kathleen Clyde elected the new chair of the Ohio Democratic Party. And a lot of people, a lot of Democrats pushed for Clyde with the understanding that Brown is going to run for governor. And so you want a party chair in there who is going to be aligned with the governor candidate, which has a lot more to do with Ohio than a U.S. Senate candidate who's mostly D.C. focused. Why Sherrod Brown, if he did indeed change his plans, did so, that we don't know that. And it might have to do with, as Karen said, Chuck Schumer meeting with him. You know, but it's all real speculation about why that's happening. I know, I mean, I talked to Joe Rugula, who's a labor union leader, and he told me that he and several other labor leaders had been trying for months to lay the groundwork for a Sherrod Brown for governor campaign. And they were not very happy with the news that Sherrod Brown's now running for Senate, because they're worried that if Republican Vivek Ramaswamy is elected in 2026, that Republicans will continue chipping away at on things like right to work, like a right to work law, like in Senate Bill 1, where they it was recently signed into law that chips away at the bargaining rights for university faculty unions, and they're worried that they're going to continue to chip away at those, and they're worried. Hmm.
I think it was Vivek Ramaswamy, though, that had maybe part, he played a role in certainly Sherrod Brown's decision to run for Senate. I mean, Ramaswamy comes into the race. He's cleared the field, essentially, because Dave Yost, the attorney general, had announced that he would run. And then with all the endorsements Ramaswamy got and all the money he's bringing in, Yost eventually suspended his campaign, actually pretty quickly. And so it's those things, the endorsements, the machine that he's built up, as well as the money he brings, that I think may have played a role here. But also, I do wonder, in the meetings with Chuck Schumer, I think maybe Sherrod Brown was talking about things like what kind of money, national money, could come in, what kind of assistance could national Democrats offer as he tries to go up against John Husted, who was appointed to that position in the U.S. Senate, but has not stood for election.
Jeremy, you looked at the differences between Sherrod Brown and John Husted as candidates. You argue that they're pretty far apart.
Pretty far apart on a number of major issues. I don't think that's a giant surprise to a whole lot of people. They are pretty much within each respectively within roughly the mainstream of their respective parties. But the two parties, of course, in this day and age are pretty far apart when it comes to things like healthcare, when it comes to trade and the economy, when it comes to furthering or blocking President Trump's agenda. Ohio voters, if this ends up being their choice next year, are going to have two very different choices in who to send to the United States Senate.
Well, and Jeremy, it looks like Sherrod Brown first is going to have to face a Senate primary. How's that shaping up?
Well, already there have been several political unknowns who have filed. And up until now, there hadn't been anyone who had been considered really a viable candidate. There's now a political newcomer named Fred Odie. He is an entrepreneur. He's a software developer from Lorain County. And he's never run for office before, but he said he made the decision before Sherrod Brown's decision, news of his decision broke, and he is going to enter the race. While he is a newcomer and not many people know who he is, he also says he is going to spend several million dollars if he finds that it's worth his while to do so. And several million dollars can introduce yourself to an awful lot of voters in the state of Ohio and absolutely make yourself, you know, a viable contender in a Democratic primary. I don't know if that will make him the front runner or anything. I think Sherrod Brown pretty much, it's very safe to call him the front runner if and when he enters. However, this could be a thorn in his side.
Hmm. Well, Karen, let's talk property taxes. Governor Mike DeWine launched a working group on property tax reform. What's that group's goal?
The group has a deadline of the end of next month to come up with recommendations on how to change Ohio's property tax laws that DeWine says he will then present to state lawmakers and try to work out something. DeWine vetoed four property tax related items in the budget that Republicans had put in, including a really big one. This is the one that would have limited school districts to holding 40% of their operating budgets in collective property taxes in their accounts, and then refunding the rest, anything over 40%, to homeowners who paid those taxes. And schools had said that was going to be disastrous for them. DeWine vetoed that, saying he was very concerned about the effect on schools. The working group, which is chaired by two Republican former lawmakers, you've got Republican former Representative and Senator Bill Seitz and former Congressman Pat Tiberi. And Seitz told me that the working group is opposed to bringing back that 40% cap. They support DeWine's decision to veto it, but they have some other ideas that they want to look at. For instance, a circuit breaker, which is something that would trigger lowering of taxes once they get to a certain threshold of income, or an increase in the homestead exemption for elderly and disabled homeowners. Those are the kind of things they're looking at. Those are bills that have been proposed before, but have not moved. And I think the goal of this working group is to get something moving, because people are truly struggling with property taxes. And there's also this threat of an amendment that a group of volunteers is trying to put on the ballot next year that would abolish property taxes entirely.
Didn't state lawmakers already come up with a whole bunch of property tax reform recommendations, Karen?
Yeah, 21 of those. It was earlier this year. Four of those were included in some form in the budget, but the majority of those obviously were not enacted. And so, again, these are ideas, the circuit breaker, the homestead exemption, these are ideas that have been out there for a while, but lawmakers haven't moved on them. And so I think some of this working group is really designed to kind of spur some action here, again, because people are really struggling.
You mentioned that former lawmaker Bill Seitz is a co-chair of this group. Does he have any concerns that this work of this group is kind of duplicating what state lawmakers have already done?
No, he says, in fact, when I spoke to him last week, he said that he thinks that what this group is doing is in addition to what lawmakers did. But the deadline, of course, is really important here. And there's 11 members on this group. They just met again this week. And they're going to take some invited expert testimony, but not testimony from homeowners. You can't just show up and complain about how high your property taxes are. They're looking for a little bit more specifics and ideas on what can be done. And the question then, of course, becomes, what are lawmakers going to do and how fast are they going to do anything? Because in front of them, they have redistricting that needs to be done by the end of the year. And, obviously a host of other things that are out there.
Well, what about this group, Karen, that's trying to abolish property taxes altogether? You mentioned that that's, still an effort that's ongoing. Where does that whole effort stand?
Well, right now it's in the signature gathering stage. It's an all-volunteer effort, and that makes a huge difference because they need to gather more than 413,000 valid signatures. They're going to need to gather a lot more than 413,000 signatures because obviously signatures get thrown out for not being valid. So this is a huge effort. They have until next July to accomplish this. And then if they do get the number of valid signatures they need, they're going to face an absolute buzzsaw when it comes to opposition from political leaders, from lawmakers, from local governments, from unions, all of these groups, because property taxes fund schools, they fund law enforcement, libraries, mental health, zoos, all of this stuff. So you're going to see a tremendous opposition to this amendment if indeed it gets to the point when it's on the ballot.
Well, Jeremy, Karen just mentioned all the different things that property taxes fund, all these different government functions. If they went away, what would pay for those services?
That's a great question. And I think among all this talk about doing away with property taxes, there's been little talk and certainly no consensus on what would replace that money. I think what that would end up looking like if it happened would be a combination of major significant budget cuts and increases in other taxes. I I would be very interested to see once. I think the feeling among state lawmakers and also, of course, among people seeking these ballot issues. And of course, just as a side note, there's also an attempt now in Butler County to put a second property tax reform issue that wouldn't eliminate property taxes, but would just cap them. That's being talked about in Butler County. But whatever happens, the focus is now on reforming it and limiting or doing away with them. And then after that, it'll either be up to local governments to decide what to do, or then state officials and others will take a look at, okay, then how do we go from here?
When I talked to one of the organizers of this group that wants to abolish property taxes, I asked him that question. What do you propose replacing that revenue with? And he said that was the legislature's job to come up with that. But he suggested income tax increases or sales tax increases. Now, when I talked to Bill Seitz about that, he said, the legislature has been cutting income taxes for 25 years. So that seems pretty unlikely that they would want to go that route. But when it comes to a sales tax, he suggested a huge increase. And there's been some calculations out there that suggest it would be about a 15% sales tax that would be needed to replace the almost $24 billion that is the collected property tax in Ohio. So we're talking about really, really big numbers here that I'm not sure that just streamlining school districts and finding waste, fraud, and abuse would be able to do.
And that's on top of there are continued efforts in the legislature to completely abolish the income tax. And that's something that Vivek Ramaswamy has called for as well. And the main way to pay for that would also be to raise sales taxes. So not only, as Karen said, you would see sales taxes drastically increase if that's what ends up happening. But if they keep moving to increase income taxes, then they would go up even further. So these folks are not on the same page about all these different initiatives to reduce or get rid of taxes. And something's got to give here.
In fact, the calculation I've seen, if the state had to replace income taxes and property taxes with a sales tax, then the state sales tax would be 19.73%. And as Seitz told me, we would need an 8-lane Brent Spence bridge to accommodate all of the traffic that would be going out of Ohio to go shopping.
Well, you know, the fact we've talked about how the legislature has been cutting income taxes for many years now. There's this push to eliminate income tax altogether. Is any of that part of the reason property taxes have gone up? I mean, is there an effort to kind of make up the revenue through property taxes, or is that connected at all?
Well, school districts and others have struggled with cuts to the local government fund and other funding cuts that they've had to experience. So, yeah, I mean, they've been looking at levies. Ohio has more school levies than any other state in the country. And the whole property tax issue is a problem that's been decades in the making. And when you start looking at the burden of property tax paid by commercial entities versus homeowners and agricultural entities, it's really shifted. It used to be about even, but now homeowners and agricultural entities pay a lot larger percentage than commercial entities do when it comes to property taxes. And some of that's related to tax abatements and other things. Mm.
Karen, when does this group hope to get something on the ballot, this group that wants to eliminate property taxes?
Well, they're aiming for next year's ballot, which means the deadline to submit signatures would be next July. And when I asked Brian Massey, one of the founders of this group, if negotiations with lawmakers could get them to the point where they would drop this effort, he said no, they were going forward no matter what. They want voters to have the option to decide here. But I think there's a real question in an all-volunteer effort if they can get the number of signatures they need, and then, of course, the opposition that they would face.
Okay, well, I've been talking with Ohio Public Media, State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler, and Cleveland.com Chief Politics Reporter Jeremy Pelzer. Thank you both so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks. You too. Up next, the latest on crime in Cincinnati and how residents are feeling about public safety. This is Cincinnati Edition. Concern over crime in Cincinnati continues, but what do the numbers show? And do the feelings of residents match the data? You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to talk about all this are WCPO 9 reporter Jay Shakur. Welcome back, Jay.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here again.
And Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Cameron Knight. Welcome back, Cameron.
Thanks so much for having me.
Cameron, the Inquirer had a headline this week that said, quote, why crime in Cincinnati is more complicated than the viral brawl video makes it out to be, end quote. Just very briefly, why is that? Why is it more complicated?
Well, I think it comes down to a couple of things. The first is that the general trend in crime over the past many years, not just in the past year over year, not just in the past couple of months, the bigger trend is that crime is reducing. And this isn't just in Cincinnati. So before everyone wants to jump on and take credit for that, it's not just in Cincinnati, it's nationwide. Generally speaking, violent crime has been reducing for many, many, many years. It's been sort of a slow process. But I think one of the things that points to that is the shootings that have happened this year in Cincinnati. I think, I haven't checked the numbers in the last day or two, but shootings in Cincinnati, the number of people shot has reduced, is down, I think, maybe 24% just over last year, which is down compared to the year before that. So that's a big part of it, is that when we talk about violent crime and the spike that has happened in downtown and over the Rhine is undeniable. This year has been, there was an increase at the beginning of this year for that kind of stuff in downtown and over the Rhine. But it's also that the crimes that we see in this viral video, this brawl, this is not really what the city is struggling. The city is struggling with, there's gun violence, which has been an ongoing thing. We've had a little over 173 shootings this year. That is a reduction from last year, like I said, 24%. But that's still 173 shootings or 75 shootings this year. That's almost more than one every other day. So that's still a lot of shootings. And the crime that is even happening in Over the Rhine in downtown is not, the brawl is not typical of that. The things that people are struggling with are fights between people individually. There's auto break-ins. There's other types of crime that are happening in those areas that draw away focus from things like for law enforcement, for our city officials. They're trying to juggle all these things because they're looking at the data too.
Jay, you talked to residents about how safe they feel. What did you hear from them?
Definitely. The big thing about how residents feel is that there is a major disconnect day to day in neighborhoods across the city, not just downtown OTR. Obviously, that's been a focus point for the city, but Cuff, Clifton, Avondale, Price Hill, about how they feel. There's been a disconnect between what the data says and how they feel, what they see. They're seeing, you know, particularly more, as he mentioned, that property crime, auto thefts, break-ins, things like that occur more. And so with that disconnect, they don't necessarily care to hear, in their view, about the data. They want to see more done. They want to see more solutions, both immediate and long term.
Yeah. And when you talk to them about the data, because I know you did, because you're such a good reporter, how do they respond? I mean, are they just like, I'm not buying it, or that doesn't apply to me? How do they really respond to the numbers when you talk to them about that?
It's both of those things. Some of them, I'm not buying it. Others are, well, that's not what I see in my neighborhood. That's not what I see when I walk out at night, or how I feel. And so a lot of them are looking more so for things to be done. They want to see action taken. They want very much so the initiatives taken in OTR, in downtown, to expand and be in Cuff, in Clifton, in Walnut Hills, et cetera.
Yeah. So is that disconnect basically coming from the fact that what they're experiencing, what they're seeing, just doesn't mesh up with the numbers?
Yes. Okay. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Cameron, the FOP is calling for the firing of Iris Rowley. I want to talk about that, but first explain who she is for anybody who isn't familiar with her and what she's been doing for the city.
So Iris Rowley is a longtime civil rights kind of leader in the city. She has has been on the scene for 25 years, if not more. She was part of the Black United Front, which was an organization that sued the city along with some others in the wake of the 2001 civil disturbance. Colloquially, you might hear it be called the riots of 2001. But there was a civil disturbance. There was, you know, the shooting of an unarmed Black person, Timothy Thomas, and that sparked a few days of disturbances. And then it eventually sparked a huge conversation in our city about what the role of policing is in the city. And that led to the collaborative agreement, which was this landmark contract between the city, the community, and the police about what everyone's role is supposed to be. And that has been an ongoing kind of developing, evolving thing since that time. And Iris has been involved with that a lot throughout the whole, throughout this whole history of the collaborative agreement. After AFTAB, Pierval was elected to be mayor, there was a time when they were looking for a new police chief after Elliot Isaac was due to retire. And during that period where they were kind of searching for a police chief, they hired on Iris Raleigh as a contractor for the city to help with the collaborative agreement, sort of keeping that momentum going, and then also to help organize the community about choosing a new police chief and also do some other kind of community engagement work for the city. And she's been receiving this, she's been on this contract since that time in 2002.
So why is the Cincinnati FOP calling for her to be fired, Cameron?
So there, the evidence that they post is a series of three videos. The first of which is an interaction with her, with an officer in Over the Rhine, where the officers are trying to do some parking enforcement, and she is like, sort of in, approaches the officers and starts trying to understand what's going on. And the situation sort of escalates where the police officer is trying to tell her, like, hey, we're just trying to do our jobs. And she goes, there's some back and forth. And at a certain point, Iris says, I don't have to do anything you tell me. And kind of walks off. There's another incident. Again, this is caught on body camera, so it's coming from the police department somehow. But the second body camera video shows a man who was accused of kind of being intoxicated in public, and the officer is trying to talk to him. And Iris again kind of steps in and appears to sort of be mediating the situation, and she tells the man, and you can, there's, it's a wide variety of ways you could interpret this, but she basically tells the man, he's kind of complaining about the police, and she tells the man, hey, if these officers are not treating you right, come make a complaint. And you can come and, you know, like, if you don't come and make a complaint, we can't do anything about it. You got to come and make a complaint if you want to do anything about that. And I think some people see that as a way of maybe de-escalating the situation and giving this guy another option instead of just arguing with a police officer right there on the street. But other people see that as a way of like kind of encouraging people to complain, make file complaints against police officers, which is what the FOP's claimed. And then there was a third video, which is like of a podcast. And she is, you know, there's some escalating kind of tense moments between her and another police officer or a retired police officer and some other people on the show.
Jay, I don't mean to throw this curveball at you, but she has been a very, Iris Raleigh's been a very visible presence in Cincinnati for a long time. Did her name or her work come up when you were talking to members of the community about crime and safety and policing? I just wonder if there's an awareness of the work that she's been doing that might have come up in those conversations.
Tuesday during our community conversation, to me, her work didn't come up directly, but throughout the week we've heard from people. Just yesterday we heard from people at a press conference in support of her about her work and how they view her relationship with the community. They see her as a liaison between police and residents and providing resources, particularly around the transit centers for young people. So her work is very, very visible. It's very well known, particularly among the minority community here in Cincinnati. They are very familiar with what she does, and many of them are supportive of her, for sure. Yeah.
What are you hearing from her supporters? What are they saying about her work and her defense?
Yeah, number one, that her work has led to a different view of policing, that her work has helped them have more confidence in policing and that their voice is actually being heard, and that she's very impactful with young people, particularly what she does around the transit centers, giving out care packages, things like that, to young people. I've talked to her directly about that particular work. So they see those tangibles of what she's doing, and they like them. They want them to continue. They want to see more of them, and they were very, particularly yesterday, very opposed to any idea of doing away with her position, modifying her position, lessening her presence as it comes to kind of being a citizen, checks and balances to policing in the city.
Mm-hmm. Cameron, I want to talk about another high-profile person in the community. This is an elected official. Cincinnati City Council member Victoria Parks announced she's stepping down from the Hamilton County Veterans Services Commission. What criticism has she faced?
So the letter that she wrote to resign was did not call out any specific situation. It was pretty vague, according to what we've reported. But the situation occurred after this brawl situation went viral all over TikTok, and we had Donald Trump Jr. tweeting about it and Elon Musk. And that's why there's even been some national media that's come to town, because of this viral fight that occurred downtown at the end of last month. And there was a Facebook post about or a social media post about this. And Victoria Parks apparently commented and said that the people involved in the video begged for the beatdown. So she said they begged for the beatdown, and I'm grateful that I have the whole story. At that point, there were rumors, but maybe it had not been as widely reported, that some of the folks involved in this situation had been shouting racial slurs in the street, and that may have played a role in what happened. But since then, there's also been, the prosecutor that's in charge of trying the cases against the folks that have been arrested in this has said that race has played no role in who's been charged or anything like that. And, there was definitely some slurs. There were slurs that were recorded in multiple videos. But it's, the prosecutor says that happened long into this situation. It was like over a minute into this situation when that kind of stuff started happening. So it's sort of still an open question. And Victoria Parks has faced a lot of criticism for that comment on social media.
Jay, have you reported on aspects of all of this, what Councilmember Parks has said or the criticism she's faced or even those parts of the video that Cameron was talking about?
Yes. When it comes to parts of the video, we got permission to air another gentleman outside of the clip that went viral of the slap. Another gentleman, white guy, saying the N-word to a couple of black men. So that is the racial aspect of this that is still, to be honest, murky, unclear as to what will be or can be done about that, or what sparked that, or why that occurred. As it comes to Parks, WCPO took the concerns from the community about a council person saying these things, essentially saying, X person deserved that beatdown, to other council members about, will you do something about this? Do you have any comment on this? And those that would talk to us essentially said that has no place on the council, those type of comments. But no, as we know, no action has been taken on that front, other than her stepping aside from this commission in a very vague way, as he mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And I think it's also worth noting that there's still a massive call in the community for the white individuals in this situation. Definitely. To be charged. There's still a lot of people who believe that there was some comments by the police chief, Chief Thiege, who said that she felt like anyone who was hurting anybody should be charged. And so far, of the seven people who have been charged and arrested in this, they've all been Black.
One of the main things, a lot of things that came out of our community conversation Tuesday about this particularly was holding the mayor and the chief accountable for their words. And they've said publicly, particularly the mayor, anyone that laid their hands on someone else should face consequences. And residents, particularly Black residents, are asking, well, not everyone seems to be facing consequences. Where are the consequences for all parties that touch someone else? So that was a big thing Tuesday.
Well, because there is also video that has surfaced of a white man who was later beaten pretty harshly, mm-hmm. slapping a Black man before the white man was beaten. So that's what these residents are talking about. That's where that comes from. Yes. Okay. Well, Cameron, this has been a subject of discussion for weeks now, and police chiefs in Hamilton County released a statement last week related to enforcement violence. Tell us briefly what the chiefs were calling for.
So the chiefs, the Police Chiefs Association, which is made up, there's about 40 or so different police jurisdictions in Hamilton County. I think most people might not realize that there are a lot of smaller police departments around Cincinnati, but still in Hamilton County. And they have an organization that got together, and they issued a statement calling for to form like a commission or a working group to close what they're calling judicial gap. And what they mean by that, kind of reading between the lines and somewhat explicitly in their statement, is that they believe that the judicial branch of our government, which is the county judges, are at least in some instances causing a problem for public safety by not giving people higher bonds, by not detaining them in jail while they await trial. And by they also mentioned sentencing, by not sentencing people harsh enough, essentially. This has been a national conversation that's been going on for, I would say, at least the past 4 or 5 years. Our previous county prosecutor, Joe Dieters, fought very hard against bail reform in Ohio. And it's been an ongoing conversation about what the role of the judges are when it comes to that. Obviously, on one side you have the Cincinnati, this Chiefs Association, the Fraternal Order of Police, the Police Union. The president Ken Kober has spoken and criticized his judges directly on his Facebook page, where he says that he'll call out specific cases where he says the bond was too low, or this judge let someone out on the street that shouldn't have been let back out on the street, that kind of thing. And then on the other side, you have a lot of judges who cannot really typically respond to those kind of comments and criticisms because they're a party to the case, and the laws surrounding judicial conduct bar them from kind of talking about and explaining why they did what they did. Mm. But we have had some cases where judges have explained more generally that there's guidelines that they follow, that, there are changing attitudes toward what cash bond actually accomplishes. So there has been a little bit of pushback to that, but I think it's hard for judges to typically defend themselves against things like that.
Jay, you've referenced a couple times this community conversation that WCPO had earlier this week. Did you hear concerns about the criminal justice system there, and what kind of solutions did residents really offer?
Yes, definitely heard concerns about the criminal justice system, particularly the court system. And the big thing was, one of the big things that I talked to residents about was transparency. One OTR resident lived in OTR for 12 plus years, loves OTR, doesn't want to live anywhere else, but she says she constantly sees particular, alleged criminals, perpetrators, suspects get out on a bond. She hears that they commit this crime in X neighborhood in OTR or street in OTR, and then she sees their criminal history and like, why were they out on the street? And so she wants more, or they want more, I should say, it was multiple people, want more information about how judges are making these decisions. Obviously, he mentioned that they can't say certain things, given the conduct rules, but they want to know more about what goes into these bond decisions. That transparency was one solution that was presented that could ease some of that perception issue that the mayor has talked about and that, you know, others have talked about, for sure.
Okay. Well, this has been a really important conversation. I've been talking with Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Cameron Knight and WCPO 9 reporter Jay Shakur. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Definitely. Thank you for having me.
Up next, Sherrod Brown isn't the only one looking to make a political comeback. We'll hear about a former Cincinnati vice mayor's plans. This is Cincinnati Edition. We started today's show talking about the potential political comeback of Sherrod Brown. Now we'll hear about a former Cincinnati vice mayor who's looking to make a comeback of his own. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to talk about that is Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Welcome back, Chris.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
So, Chris, former Cincinnati Vice Mayor Christopher Smitherman wants to run for city council again. I know he appeared recently at a town hall meeting about crime with Vivek Ramaswamy, who's running for governor in Ohio. Is crime the big reason he says he wants to run again?
It is one of the big reasons, yes. Crime and maybe real estate development are the two things that he mentioned the other day when he was on WKRC AM to announce his campaign. The topics that you just spent a long time talking about in the previous segment, I think, are at the top of his mind. But he also sees the Hyde Park development on Hyde Park Square as an issue that is resonating with a lot of people in Cincinnati, and the lack, I guess, of, in his view, city hall and city council listening to neighborhoods about these development issues. That's another factor as well.
Where is he in the process of getting on the ballot?
Well, he's gathering signatures. He's got to get 500 by next Thursday at 4 p.m. So he's got a busy weekend ahead of him. He's been gathering them, I think, at one of the places is Jim and Jack's, the place out on the river that the town hall with Vivek Ramaswamy was held. And so they've got a busy weekend ahead of them.
Yeah. Well, I know he's not the only former council member who is looking to regain a seat. Former council member Steve Gooden is running with the Charter Committee. Former council member Lakita Cole is running with the Charter Committee. And it sounds like there might be another former council member who's considering a run. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So Wednesday into Thursday, we started to hear rumors that former councilwoman Liz Keating, who served for about 3 years amid the 2020 corruption scandal and then was elected in her own right in 2021, is also looking at a campaign. She talked to me briefly yesterday about that. She is gathering the signatures right now. She has not made up her mind 100% that she's going to do it, but you don't typically put in this type of effort unless you're really kind of looking hard at it.
Yeah, it's a lot of work to gather those signatures. Well, you mentioned that Liz Keating served on council for about 3 years. How long did Christopher Smitherman serve on council?
He served quite a bit longer. He had a number of stints on council. This would be, I believe, his third if he's elected in November. So he was first elected the very first time was in 2003 when he finished seventh. He lost his reelection bid in 2005. And then he kind of made a political comeback in 2011, and he was elected two other times in 2013 and 2017. During the last 4 years that he was on council, he was Mayor John Cranley's vice mayor. It was an interesting situation because Cranley, of course, was a Democrat, and Smitherman is an independent, sometimes flirting with the idea of running as a Republican for other offices. Certainly Republicans in Cincinnati really have taken to him, and I think that they are probably going to support him if he does run.
What are the rules about term limits for city council?
Term limits, you get 8 years, and then you have to take a break. And so he is, of course, eligible to run again now that he has been off council for, I believe it will be 4 years now.
Okay. You know, we've talked about these people who are trying to make a comeback. How has the political climate changed since Christopher Smithers was on council, since Liz Keating and Steve Gooden were on council, and since Lakita Cole has been on council? It's been longer for her.
Yeah, it's been quite a change in the last few years. I mean, Smitherman hasn't been on a city election ballot since 2017, so that's nearly 8 years now. And in that time, what has happened is the city has trended more Democratic. And in the 2021 election, of course, Councilwoman Keating was the only non-Democrat to be elected. She finished ninth that year. And then in 2023, all nine council members who were elected were Democrats, and Keating finished 10th that year. This is a really interesting, development that we have. We're going to have a large field of council candidates, and that is standing in stark contrast to 2 years ago when we only had 10. I mean, there could be, 20, maybe even 30 candidates, depending on how the signature gathering process goes. Traditionally, Lucy, we saw a situation on city council for decades where the Democrats would hold the majority, but there would always be a couple of Republicans, maybe charterites, maybe people who were independents, maybe people who were cross-endorsed by the Charter Committee and the Democratic Party, or the Charter Committee and the Republican Party. And they would often form a coalition that was outside of that Democratic majority. And so for the last 4 years, we've seen a situation where Democrats have kind of had a lock on city council and on the way things go there. So this will be a chance to upend the table there and maybe go back to the future a little bit on that.
Well, we're almost at the end of our time together, but we're going to have you back on the program later in a few weeks to talk about Cincinnati's housing needs. Can you give us just a little tease about what you set out to find about that?
Yeah, we have a cover story that ran online and in print this week, just looking at downtown development and why we haven't seen a new apartment building built in the last 4 years. For a while there, we were seeing about one per year, and we haven't seen one in a while. And we looked at what that, why that potentially is, and kind of, what impact on the city's housing crisis, if you want to call it that, that has. I mean, downtown's a very dense place, and it could be denser, and it could, go a long way to dealing with the housing crisis.
Well, we will talk more with you about that in the next few weeks. I've been talking with Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Thank you so much for your time today, Chris.
Thanks, Lucy.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Her son, Dorian, is her helper today. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you have a great weekend.